February. The time of year when a young emergency doctor's mind drifts to thoughts of fancy and toward the upcoming in-training exam. But never fear. To help give you the boost of confidence you need to get more points on this exam, we here at AZMCast will be doing our annual in-service review. As always, we're going to take a step back from the new and innovative and go back to basics, covering one of the sections from the ITE to help you cram a few more bits of data into your head before you have to spill it out onto the paper. We apologize to those of you that are not emergency medicine residents, but we take a little time to do something special for our doctors in training. We'll get back to whatever it is that we do in March, but until now, we're going to be talking about HEENT, high-yield emergency medicine topics. But to be honest with you, I doubt that you residents need this. You're already so smart and caring and thoughtful. You're a good doctor. Come on, it's okay. Acknowledge it. Say it. Say out loud, I am a good doctor. Now say, I will do well on this test. I mean, come on. You've trained, you've studied, you've seen a ton of patients. And for you, well, for you, this test is going to be easy. That's why I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning. Yeah. That's why I'm easy. Happy February. We are finally done doing guidelines for at least a month or two, which I actually thought was pretty good. I mean, to go through all that, it's a big excuse for me to read them and feel good about knowing what they say because I just taught everybody, even though I just learned it about 10 minutes prior.
It's good to look at them and see what we used to do, what we're going to do, and what people are recommending we should do, and then think about what we want to do.
And Jared, sadly, is not here today. He's injecting mice with drugs.
Mouse killer.
I don't know if this is at home, if he's just doing this in his free time, or if this is a lab experiment, but we're going to substitute in a couple Jaredisms for here. See, here's the thing that I hate about what we're about to do.
So if you think about it, if you really, really think about it.
See, here's the thing, is if... Here's what I hate that they make you do. Like, here's what you're supposed to do. Here's what I do. You shouldn't do that. But here's what I do that you should never do that I might not do in about 6 months.
Yeah, I keep changing my mind on this stuff. I used to do this, but I don't know.
I read this thing in the New Yorker that... Okay. That's what happens when you don't show up to recording, Jared.
Oh, right. Jared.
So it is February, which means that we're going to take a break from new and advanced literature and cutting-edge stuff and go back to old, dull, boring, and about 5 years behind. So we're going to do the in-service review for the residents. Now, old, boring, and 5 years behind is actually still pretty good because you need to know this stuff. Some things don't change. People still get pneumonia, and you need to know what pneumonia is and how to treat it. People still get syphilis. Yes, syphilis, the stupidest bacterium on earth. People still get it because people are stupider. So we're going to do an in-service review. Residents, for some reason, have liked this in the past, so hopefully you still get something out of it. So Brian and I are going to be talking about HEENT. Talking with some of the residents, a lot of you guys listen to podcasts. A lot of you will read papers and will send me papers that I have never heard of and feel foolish for not knowing. But I'd like to reiterate something one of our faculty said when asked, is there anything you would have done different in residency? The faculty member responded, I wish I would have read a book. And what he meant by that was not, you know, Anne of Green Gables, but I think he wished that he would have read a textbook, you know, some kind of good foundation, because it's real tough to build all of this evidence if you don't have the foundation. So Brian and I would like to encourage you all to read a book this month.
I like Tintin Alley.
Tintin Alley is good. However, I dropped Tintin Alley on my foot one time, and ever since I haven't been able to read it. You could also, if Tintin Alley is not enough, you could also read Rosens and Volume 2 and the appendix to Volume 2. Or you could do what I like to do, which is to read some kind of abbreviated bullet point version. I like Just the Facts by Tintin Alley. I like First Aid, some of those. They're a little bit softer. They pretty much all sound the same, though. But read something, because when you read this stuff, it's going to give you the foundation to pass your boards. I want to talk about some quick test-taking strategies. When you take these tests, make sure you sleep, make sure you eat, make sure you go pee. And then get in front of your test and look at the questions in a way that makes sense to you. Try, when you read the question, to figure out what are they getting at. Do they want me to give a diagnosis? Do they want me to give a management plan? Do they want me to show that I know the pathophysiology? What is this question getting at that's so important? Because people that write questions, these item writers, are trying to make sure that you know something about emergency medicine that they feel is important. So if you can try to ferret out what on earth do they think is so important about this question, then it'll help you to get the answer.
Yeah, you want to make sure, don't study the night before. Take the night before off, watch a movie, go for a walk, do something.
Something that takes all, drains all the stupid out of you, like Dude, Where's My Car? That'd be perfect.
That's a great movie to watch the night before. Another test-taking strategy is answer every question. Some people don't finish the test. Answer every question. And it's okay to guess on some of these. If you don't know, guess as opposed to leaving it blank. But I agree. Like Aaron said, they're going to do not just what am I looking for, but a lot of times it's the next step. So the question may describe something, but it isn't going to be the treatment there, but maybe who should I consult with? Or they want you to take that next step beyond just answering the concept that they want you to know.
Yeah. They may show you a picture of an eye and then ask you, what is the best treatment for this condition? They won't tell you what it is. They'll expect you to diagnose it. So unfortunately with those, if you get the diagnosis wrong, you're going to get the question wrong. But looking at some of these color pictures in atlases and stuff will be helpful. The other thing that they want to know on pretty much all of these questions is, can you recognize sick or not sick? So if you read the prompt and you go, wow, this patient sounds sick, i.e. the vitals are abnormal, then usually when they ask what is the most appropriate, they want you to pick the most emergent need that needs to be addressed in the sick patients. Now, maybe they'll say, what's the most appropriate disposition or therapy if they're not as sick? But if they say, what is the next most important step on a sick patient? You all know this. Airway, breathing, circulation, IVO2 monitor, advanced airway equipment to the bedside, finger stick blood sugar, antibiotics for a septic patient. You know this stuff. So don't get hung up just because it's the test. So remember that in residency, all of your attendings, all of your nurses, everyone else, they are going to teach you everything you need to know about how to be a good physician, okay? This test has no bearing on whether or not you are a good physician. This test has everything to do with, can you get points on an exam? So like Brian said, try to get points on an exam. If you look at a question and it spills over onto the second page and you have no idea what it's asking, skip it. Come back to it later and pick up the points on the 5 easy questions on paronychia, okay? I like to circle those questions, go, I don't have time to read this question and do a 2x2 square to figure out the sensitivity and specificity. That's just not going to be a good use of my time. Instead, I'm going to pick up the easy questions, I'll come back at the end, write up my 2x2 box, and expertly do the sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive value. Because I took 5 in-service exams during my residency.
3 wasn't good enough for you, Aaron?
Nope, 5. I stuck around for a couple extra years.
This is a different philosophy than you may hear from your residency directors, but
I'm actually one of those.
I know. So I want to tell you this. So my philosophy with the in-service exam is not to study for it. Why? Because I think you should see where you're at right now with your knowledge base. Then you should study the following year based on how you did did on the in-service exam to prepare for the next one. Or if you're a third year taking it, to prepare for your written boards in the fall. So to me, it's a measuring stick of where you're at. So don't worry if your score is horrible. You have a year to improve, or 6 months if you're waiting for your written boards in the fall.
That works well if you're an intern and you've never taken one. However, that I agree with that perspective as long as you study in between in-service exams.
Yes.
If Brian is not saying don't study ever.
Correct. I'm saying read the textbook. That's what I'm saying.
He's saying don't cram for the in-service exam because that is beside the point. That's not what you should be doing. I will say that there are some questions that you should cram into your brain real fast right before you go because you can pick up a couple extra questions. They love to ask about, I don't know,
talks.
Ciguatera. Strange ones like that.
Things that you don't see on a regular basis, that you don't know the drugs off the top of your head, the things that you haven't seen before that are rare, those are the ones you want to look up because you don't need to look up heart failure. You don't need to look up acute coronary disease. You don't need to look up how to read an EKG. You've done this. You've seen this. You've treated these patients.
Those of us in Tucson need to look up marine envenomations. Do I pee on this? Do I not pee on this? That's an important thing to know that, you know, we don't do that all the time. Those of us in Tucson need to look up management of frostbite. We're not going to see that all the time. Those of you outside of Tucson need to look up valley fever. We see that so often that we could probably quote you the titer ratio. But those of you outside might want to look up, oh, San Joaquin Valley, valley fever. We hurdle over those questions. We don't even finish reading the thread because we know what they're going to ask. It's valley fever. And we're expecting, that's it? That's all you want me to do is diagnose valley fever? So figure out the stuff in your region that maybe you don't see all the time. Those of us in Tucson, Lyme disease. Read some stuff about Lyme disease because that'll be some quick stuff to pick up that we just don't see a whole lot of. All right, so let's get to the actual material. So we were going to start with HEENT because Brian and I see this kind of stuff all the time, and most HEENT stuff is not sick. So we don't need Jared to tell us why you're going to die of your otitis media.
Right. Most colds are colds. They don't need ECMO.
So starting with H.
He has name.
You look at the head. And that's pretty much it. If you see something growing out of somebody's head, you should probably cut it off or, you know, take a sample of it. If it's an abscess, drain it. Most head stuff, so to speak, I mean, they're not going to ask you much about head. So I think that we can skip H.
Yes.
So we're going to go to eyes then.
Oh, I hated the colonel with his wee, beady eyes.
I'll be honest. I personally stink at eyes. I really have the hardest time with it. I really regret not doing some kind of an opto rotation in medical school or residency. How do you feel about eyes?
I think that even though you're not good at eyes, on a board exam, you can be very good at eyes. Because you don't have to know or have to be able to see that fundoscopic exam. They show it to you. You don't have to know if there's cell or flare. They tell you if there's cell or flare.
So let's start with the eye exam. So when you examine your eyes, you should be doing it in not necessarily a stepwise pattern, but making sure you don't miss anything. So this will usually start, hopefully, with a visual acuity in triage. And if they haven't gotten the visual acuity, they get the visual acuity. That's akin to not getting the temperature or the heart rate or the blood pressure or the SAT, which no one would ever do. You got to make sure if they have an eye complaint, you get a visual acuity. Then you take a look at the eyes, look at the pupil, look at the cornea, look at the lids, look for extraocular movements, look at the eyelids, look at the orbits, and then we kind of go into more of the testing, the fluorescein exam, the slit lamp exam, the intraocular pressures, and the fundoscopic exam. So initially, when you're doing your visual inspection, you're looking at the eyes, you're looking for asymmetry of the pupils, you're looking for reactivity of the pupils to make sure that they're both equally reactive. You're looking for conjunctivitis. You're looking for limbic flush to see if there's any kind of redness around the iris that would make you think more of an iritis than just a conjunctivitis. And you look to see if they have pain on any of this evaluation when you're just straight out looking at the eye. And hopefully the ones you pick up, Proptosis, there's an eye coming out at you compared to the other one, or a big swollen orbit. Those are things that you should pick up pretty quickly.
Yeah. Sometimes they'll show pictures of hyphemas or hypopneons and give a history of that. They may show a normal-looking eye, but redness around the eye. So you're thinking of preceptal or orbital cellulitis in those patients as well.
Extraocular movements, you can do this with ease and probably boredom in adults. With kids, it's a bit more of a challenge. Now, why would you care about extraocular movements on a kid? Well, it's one of the ways you can differentiate an orbital from a periorbital cellulitis. If they have pain with extraocular movements, that's because they have pus in their eye. So one of the ways that I will assess for this is my cell phone with some version of little kids' video. That I kind of write off as, no, I have this for the kids. It's not because I like watching Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. It's because the kids like it. I move that video in four directions. So I move it in four directions, and I would go up, down, left, right, and I make sure the kid tracks with me. And I've had kids that stop, and they won't move their eyes. They'll keep their eyes straight ahead, but if they try to go left or right, they'll move their head. And so I get them all the way until they can't move their head anymore. And if they stay looking straight, but you can tell they're straining, that's a bit more concerning. All right, so once you're doing the extraocular movements, you're looking for range of motion, and the other thing you're looking for is nystagmus. And you can have nystagmus in a couple different directions. Usually it's going to be a lateral nystagmus. Vertical nystagmus, if you see that, this is one of those BizBuzz things. Vertical nystagmus, think PCP. Hopefully not in a child, but you never know. Vertical nystagmus is something that's pretty well associated with PCP intoxication, so something else to keep up if they see that. Any other thoughts on nystagmus?
You can see rotary nystagmus, and if you're seeing horizontal nystagmus, probably more of a neurologic component, alcohol. Maybe there's a inner ear dysfunction, a peripheral vertigo, but if you're starting to see vertical or rotary, you need to think of some other central nervous system component.
And then one of the other things that you should be seeing with this, if they have pain with extraocular movements, cavernous sinus thrombosis. This is the triangle of death. They don't pop your zits under your eye and next to your nose. Brian, have you ever seen one of these?
I have seen two.
I've never seen one, so I'm going to let you talk about it then.
So cavernous sinus thrombosis, or basically DVT of the brain, you can think about from a couple presentations-wise. It's usually a headache with some neurologic component, whether headache and then they had a seizure, but they still have some headaches, headache and they have a focal neurologic component. A lot of times they will present with either a history of young female on birth control pills or some procoagulant, their tobacco user, long trip. They may start to present with that. They may start to describe a HENT infection, maybe an ear infection, a sinus infection. Sinus infections are classically taught, and it's an extension from those that cause some irritation in the vasculature in the brain, causing a thrombosis. These are rare to find, and it's hard to find if it's just a headache. You really need some other focal neurologic something that's going to force you into an imaging study. You will probably miss it if you just see on a headache, but on the test, they're going to have something else to go with it. The treatment, just like any DVT, would be anticoagulation. The study of choice, if that's what they're asking, would be either a CT venogram or an MRI. You can see these on a non-con CT. You would see a delta sign on CT in the where the sagittal sinus comes down in a back cut, and you would see a, hard to describe, but you'd see a black triangle in the white triangle where the sinus should be. I doubt they're going to show you that picture, but they may show you something else with a CT venogram and a large deficit on one side.
And these are usually going to be infected as well, because it's a clot in a part of the vasculature that drains directly back to your brain versus actually going around, routing out. So that's why you can get in trouble with these. Never seen one. Hope not to. But on the test, you got a good chance at it. So moving on, we'll take a look at the eyelids. Looking at the eyes, you should be able to see if the orbits are big and swollen and painful. This happens to me a lot in the PZD, where a parent will bring in their kid and they'll have this fluffiness around the eye. The eyelid's a little bit uniformly swollen. And I can't tell. Has a kid been rubbing at it? Or is it infected? Or is it some kind of an allergic reaction? You can certainly have all three of those. And you could probably have all three of them at the same time. I've kind of found that between allergic and infectious, there's a different kind of edema that they'll get. They'll get this light, fluffy, pastry kind of edema with allergic reactions, and they'll get more of a indurated, tense, and certainly more painful edema with an infection. And then just rubbing at it could be anywhere in between. Classically, this used to be a Hib infection, Haemophilus influenza. That being said, we don't see Hib that much anymore. In 10 years, I've seen 2 cases of Hib, and I see a lot of kids. So the old treatment used to be amoxiclav in order to make sure you pick up Hib. The new biggest cause of this is going to be staph and strep. So the classic treatment, give them Augmentin, not necessarily going to be the best treatment for them because you got to make sure you cover for staph and strep. They might have Hib if they're just so unlucky, or if they're less than 2 months of age and they haven't gotten their vaccines yet, I would be very worried. But in reality, you should probably make sure you're covering for staph and strep, and that's something that should be reflected on the test now. This test may be a little bit behind because we can't incorporate every new finding because then we got to retract them, but it's certainly not going to be 20 years behind.
Yeah, so if you're looking at eyelids and swelling, I agree with Aaron. I think just the eyelid swell in an allergic or someone who's rubbing, but if you start to see the around the eyebrow, the lower upper orbit, that starts to swell or have some redness, I think that's where you start to think of a preseptal or septal cellulitis. And again, the differentiation for that is the sicker ones when they have pus in the eye or maybe an entrapment of one of the extraocular muscles. For the orbital cellulitis, those will need to be admitted. They will need imaging, and they will need IV antibiotics. The other ones you can treat. Their kid has some swelling around, some pink tinge maybe to the orbit. They have some swelling, fever plus or minus. Those can go home, and the most common organism for both will be staph. So if they say, what is the most common organism that causes this, that would be staph.
And I find that unlike ears and throats, which I tend to undertreat probably because most of them are viruses, if I see this, I tend to overtreat them because remember in the emergency department, we're looking for life, limb, sight, and fertility threatening issues. And this could be something bad. I don't want a kid to need eye surgery.
Yeah, and you don't see this that often. So you're not overtreating a large population with this. So other eyelid conditions you may see, a sty. A sty just looks like a pocket of pus around your eyelash glands. And if you want to call it a chalazion, an internal heraldium, or however they say that.
Geraldo Rivera.
Then those are the internal meibomian glands, or whatever they call them. But those may be 2 pictures that they show you and ask what the treatment is.
Those are 3 words I've never known how to pronounce.
No. They roll off the tongue.
So, you know, the difference, chalazion is going to be more on the inside. It's going to be more chronic usually. And it's going to be irritating, but it's not going to be incredibly painful. Versus a sty, which is going to be more acute. It's going to be more on the outside. And it's going to be exquisitely painful. Someone once taught me the chalazions have been around for a while, so you can chillax, which kind of dates that reference as well. So.
And the treatment will be warm compresses if they're, and urethromycin ointment. If you need to, you could incision and drain them if they're really bad.
I've had a couple of these that were pretty big, and at least where we work, ophthalmology is pretty quick to see these patients, so I send them out. I prefer not to slice into somebody's eyelid if I can avoid it. The last thing is, along with eyelids, is blepharitis, where you just have inflammation of the margin of the eyelid. And again, something like some erythromycin will be fine to cover that.
Right, and you may see these little crusties along multiple eyelash glands as opposed to a single one where you'd see with the chalazion or sty.
And keep in mind that you should also evert the eyelids to look, make sure there's not a foreign body underneath there that keeps scratching at the eye. If you do have somebody, typically kids that wake up and parents bring him in and say, he had his eyes crusted shut this morning and we need to take him to daycare or school, can we please have some eye drops? This used to be my pet peeve because I would try to explain to parents and say, no one has ever died of pain pink eye. There's a South Park episode about pink eye. No one has ever died of pink eye. Why do we overtreat this? This is such a ridiculous waste of resources. But Jared's not here, so I got to take over for that. So I asked one of the ophthalmologists one time. I didn't actually ask. I ranted. And the ophthalmologist very kindly, very nicely said, you know, we can't really distinguish between bacterial and viral conjunctivitis early on, and the systemic absorption of drops or ointment is very low, so the side effects are pretty low. The help is pretty high if it is, the benefit is pretty high if it is bacterial, so we overtreat. And I kind of felt foolish. And then I realized that's most of these parents' keys to get back into school, back into daycare. So I'm pretty liberal with rubbing goop on their eyes. Probably what helps is if you give them the ointment, have them rub it on the eyelid, you rub all of that sleep out of their eye, and then now they look great. So,
and it usually will be, they say it's worse in the morning. That's because the kid slept and nothing drained out of the eye. Don't let them use hydrogen peroxide on their eyes. That's, I've seen that, to get rid of the crusties. That's not a good idea. Just warm water. Things that you may see, though, on the test would be a neonate with conjunctivitis. That's a different story. A one-month-old with conjunctivitis is different than the kid with the runny nose and a little bit of drainage out of the eye. And so those you're going to need to treat differently.
So you'll have the one-month-old with conjunctivitis. They have a red inflamed eye. They have pus coming out of the eye. That is very worrisome for something like trachoma, which we need to get opto involved with early. There is also the kid who just has, who's 1 month of age and just has tearing coming out of the eye. Mom just thinks that they're always tearing and sometimes they have some goop on the eyes, but the conjunctiva itself is fine. It's not red. It's not inflamed. There's no irritation. That's probably just dacrocystitis, just a narrowed gland in between the eye and the nose that's just getting a little bit backed up and causing them to tear. It's just not draining the way that it should. That is incredibly common. The primary care doctors, the pediatricians see it all the time. So don't worry about that one. That one, we usually just tell parents, warm compresses, wipe it away. They'll grow out of it. All the tubes inside of kids are very small, so don't worry about that. Maybe down the line, you'll see an eye doctor who will kind of ram it out with a metal prong, but usually it's not going to be a problem. So make sure that your conjunctivitis is not just, oh, they have sleep on their eye. You know, they have goop that's crusted over, so it must be something bad.
And the allergic conjunctivitis, they'll usually, if they're talking about that, we'll talk about maybe a runny nose, lots of itching, a kind of a thinner, watery, maybe some swelling, but it won't be a thick drainage that you see and less red.
So most all of this you can do on a patient. You can evaluate without actually touching them. Now we have to touch the patient and their eye, which I think every doctor has one or two parts of the body that just freaks them out. For me, it's eyes and teeth. I just can't do it.
I think for Jared, it was toes. I don't think he liked toes.
Okay, we'll have to ask him about
that. He'll correct us.
I remember on OB, one that we just had a C-section, and you know, digging around, and I've been delivering babies all day, and they had the mom intubated, and the anesthesiologist starts sucking stuff out of the ET tube to get ready to extubate the patient, and the OB residents were like, "Oh, that is so disgusting. I hate that." I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." After what you were messing around with, you're grossed out by a little bit of ET tube phlegm.
Yeah, that white Crisco stuff. I still don't know what that is with the birth.
Everybody's got something. So eyes freak me out. So when I get in there, I want to do it very quickly. So we'll start with the fluorescein exam. So you get a little bit of fluorescein, you get a black light, and you're staining the cornea. And what you're looking for is any signs of inflammation or injury. So you want to look to see that it's actually over the cornea. Like I said, I stink at eyes. So I'll be humble enough to admit that I have called ophthalmology for a corneal abrasion that was nowhere near the cornea. It was actually a scratch of the sclera, which is not a big deal. So make sure it's actually over the cornea, because that's where it's a problem. But you'll see this nice bright green uptake. It's fun to do if you ever play laser tag or go to a club, or for for Halloween. It's fun as well. And just shine the black light in your eyes. That's your costume. So you want to look for abrasions, ulceration, and then the coup de grace, the Seidel sign, where you take a look under fluorescein and you actually see aqueous humor coming out through the anterior chamber like a beautiful fluorescent waterfall.
And they will. That's something that they like to put on the exam. Of the fluorescein stuff, they will comment, they'll show you a picture of either an abrasion, they will show you a dendrite for herpes simplex, or they will show you a Seidel sign, which will look like an abrasion, but then it has a round drop-like feature heading down south. So that's as best as they can describe with a Seidel sign. So if you see that, know that you're dealing with a totally different patient than just the abrasion.
If you decide to do your fluorescein at the same time as your slit lamp exam, you can use the cobalt light and you can look at it all at the same time. But the slit lamp is specifically to look at the anterior chamber. So what you're looking for is a couple things. You're looking for cell and flare. You're looking for a hyphema, some kind of layering of blood or layering of pus with the hypopion. So you're looking for infection or bleeding. The last thing is you're looking for some kind of an embedded foreign body or a rust ring for somebody that was working on their car, got metal shavings in their eye. For the hyphema and the hypopion, if you've got someone that's been laying down for a long time, it will layer out according to gravity. It'll layer out along the bottom. If you sit them up real fast and take a look, you may not see that little meniscus at the bottom. So try to have them sit up for 20 minutes or so to let all that stuff layer out so you can see that nice white meniscus in the hypopion or the nice red meniscus in the hyphema.
And the hypopneon you're going to see in someone who has a very sick, infected eye. They're going to get admitted. They're going to get IV antibiotics, and an ophthalmologist is going to see them emergently. If they have a hyphema, you're thinking more of a traumatic injury. They do need to sit up at that point, too. The reason is they don't want to, if there is blood there, they don't want it laid back, going back and settling in the orbit itself of the eye. But the ophthalmologist need to see them, not as emergently, but they need to see them within 24 hours, usually in a consultation, an inpatient basis. And those are the ones you'd be more worried about, either a lens dislocation or a ruptured globe.
And the other caveats to people that are more concerning, so you are concerned about someone who's on blood thinners and has a hyphema. You are concerned about someone who has sickle cell and has a hyphema because they're at risk for having that clot off and they'll get acute angle glaucoma. You want to make sure people avoid aspirin or any kind of NSAIDs if they have a hyphema as well. Going into glaucoma, the next thing you're going to do after you've done your slit lamp is your intraocular pressure. If you can find the TonoPen or whatever you happen to use, at least for us, it's usually in some place, it's like the elf on the shelf. Sometimes you'll find it and you're like, what are you doing here next to the speculums? And so you find it and you want to get it calibrated and tap it directly over the cornea. Again, don't tap the sclera, don't tap the nasal bone. Really make sure that you get them numbed up with some tetracaine or proparacaine and tap it right over the cornea because that's what you're looking for. You get these intraocular pressures on both sides and you hope that it's less than 20. If not, then you have to be concerned that this patient has glaucoma and you want to start your treatments. Contraindications to doing this, you do not want to do intraocular pressures if you're worried about a globe rupture because you're going to make it worse and you're going to squish all that eye goo out of their eye. And the other one would be if you're worried about endophthalmitis, some kind of a bad infection that you got a shriveled eye, or a glass eye. Probably not very effective on a glass eye either.
They're pretty solid. High pressures. But this is why you always stain an eye. If they ask you what is the next step, you will do fluorescein prior to intraocular pressure so that you don't do your pressures before you realize there is a globe rupture.
And then theoretically, the next one you do is a fundoscopic exam.
That's a great exam for certain people with dilators and the double, I don't know what those ophthalmologists, like the reverse thing that they have. They got two lenses. It looks like they're glasses that are floating monocles or something.
I had one of the residents tell me he went into opto because he loved carrying around that briefcase. I told him he needed a pair of handcuffs like the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
So the fundoscopic exam, if you can get them dilated, great. Every once in a while you have a patient, you're like, oh my gosh, I can see everything. Everybody come here and look at this guy. guy's eye, and you burn out his retina as you're trying to take a look. What you're looking for is you're looking for retinal detachment. You're looking for retinal vein or retinal artery occlusion, and you're looking for signs of optic neuritis. You're looking for an increased cup to disc ratio to look for signs of papilledema as well. So those are the big four things, and those are the big four things that we're looking for.
And they'll show you pictures of fundoscopic images on the exam, and they may mix it in with someone who's had a head injury and just show you that, trying to show you the papilledema. They may show you sudden vision loss in an eye and start to show you maybe the thunder and
blood and thunder,
right? So you may see some of these or a pallor in the central concern, like for a central retinal artery occlusion. So they may show you some pictures and then ask you on that. So they do like to show fundoscopic. The good thing is you don't have to be good at doing it. You just have to know what it looks like.
Yeah, you don't have to be able to perform it. You just have to be able to recognize what you see. So look at some pictures. This is, again, one of those things.
Yeah.
Look at some pictures of retina before you take your test. Don't cram, but look at a couple pictures before you go in. So having done all of these together, one last thing about fundoscopic, we are getting much better, much more facile with ultrasound. I still don't think you can replace a fundoscopic exam with an ocular ultrasound, but man, are we getting close.
And they may have ultrasound pictures now. I don't know. I would be surprised
if
they
did. I'd be very surprised.
The only pictures on ultrasound I think that they would show would be, one, a lens dislocation, so your lens is sitting on the bottom or out of its normal spot. Two, a retinal detachment would be the only other thing, and that would be a floppy line in through the middle of the orbit on your ultrasound. But those would be the only two I can imagine that they would try to show.
Yeah, so keep in mind that this is going to be a exam of what the American Board of Emergency Medicine expects all emergency doctors to be able to interpret. I don't think it's going to be on the exam.
So.
A fast exam, they will absolutely expect you to recognize. Looking at the fluorescein exam and seeing the Seidel sign, that's something they absolutely will expect you to do. I don't think retinal ultrasound's going to be there yet.
Probably 5 years. Maybe.
So, Brian, you want to do a little biz buzz real quick?
So, we talk about blood and thunder. That's looking at a central venous occlusion. And those usually have a history of some kind of vision loss, usually not as sudden, but unfortunately, there's not much for treatment for a lot of these. So, if you see blood and thunder, it'll look like flashes of red across the fundoscope with, it's kind of a fuzzy, it's hard to describe, it's like a fuzzy looking, you don't see nice normal blood vessels that are going from thick to narrow.
Kind of looks like a picture from the Hubble telescope at a galaxy. So imagine that you've got the vein backed up, so it's engorged, so everything is going to be backed up behind it. And it's actually, it's very pretty.
It's beautiful. You could put it on your wall.
Yeah, I think it'd be really nice. Now that versus the pallor that you'll see with a central artery occlusion. That's what you'll see. And both of those should give you painless vision loss. Am I correct on that? Dendritic fluorescence, when you do your fluorescein exam, so the dendritic pattern is going to be herpeticus, zostris, ophthalmicus, and that's going to be a problem that the ophthalmologists are going to need to see quickly. Usually it's like every 37-minute eye drops for the next 2 days until they see them.
Right. They'll go from like every hour to every 3 hours, depending on how involved it is. But do not give steroid drops. That's one thing. If they ask you what is the next step, would you give steroids? No, if you see a dendrite.
Okay. Increased cup to dish ratio, possibly in somebody who has the worst headache of their life.
Papilledema.
All right. Fixed mid-dilated pupil. Someone that just came out of a movie theater, went out into the sunlight, and went, oh my gosh, my eye is going to pop out of my head.
That'll be acute angle glaucoma.
All right, great. Flashers and floaters. Lake Havasu during spring break, right?
Yeah. bring your camera. These would be, depending on what they are, could be a vitreous detachment, could be a retinal detachment. If you start to see flashers or floaters, say they've had an exposure to either welding, they may give you a history, like a keratitis. You could also have someone with almost like a snow blindness or a water blindness, reflective water, not wearing sunglasses, can irritate, and they may see more floaters or flashers than normal. But if you see, if you truly get a good history, it's usually retinal detachment that they're going to be going for.
And then the last one, painless loss of vision. So this will be your central retinal vein or central retinal artery occlusion, but it may also be optic neuritis they're getting at in the setting of somebody who has multiple sclerosis. So make sure you don't miss that one. Painless vision loss should be the first thing that you would think of would be optic neuritis. And if they show you an optic fundoscopic exam with the blood and thunder, well, there you go. If they show you one that just has the pale, the pallor to the retina, that's going to be central artery occlusion. If they show you the more inflamed with the cup to disc, that's going to be your MS flare, your optic neuritis. So again, take a couple looks at pictures of fundi before you take the exam.
And they will give you something with the painless vision loss. They won't just say, oh yeah, what the patient had painless vision loss, what is it? They'll give you something else.
Give you something like the patient kept dropping her coffee cup, or the patient had trouble speaking, some kind of motor.
Right,
usually.
Or they have a history of anticoagulants before, and they had, or hypercoagulable disorder and hypertension, that's probably more of your central venous, and oh, they've had a history of stroke, now all of a sudden they got sudden vision loss, and it's painless. Think more of your central retinal artery occlusion.
So I think we're done with eyes, which is good. So we're going to move on to ears.
Why the ear, man?
The next E. So I'm going to take otitis media. This is a personal crusade of mine. So otitis media, there are guidelines for otitis media of when to treat, when not to treat, and I will say that greater than 90% of these are going to be viruses. However, we treat them all the time. Why do we treat them? Because everyone that comes to the emergency department needs a prize for coming. They need a door prize. Thank you for coming. Here's a piece of paper with my signature on it. You can try to sell it at a hobby shop along with your Kobe Bryant signed basketball card, or you can take it to a pharmacy where they'll give you drugs. So they all need something. But otitis media, to have a real concerning bacterial otitis media, you need a few things. You need less than 24 hours of onset, you need fever associated with it, and you need severe pain associated with a middle ear effusion. Now, the middle ear effusion, lots of things will give you a middle ear effusion. You've got your eustachian tubes that attach into your middle ear and into your throat. So you can get eustachian tube dysfunction or edema just from having a viral syndrome and get fluid backed up in your ear. But when you get enough fluid that you see a bulging, almost like conch shell looking tympanic membrane with white pus behind it, that's concerning enough to me. I'll be willing to treat that. There's clearly pus back there. With these infections, what you'll see usually with a tympanic membrane, I describe it to parents as it looks like saran wrap. You can kind of see behind it. It looks like a plastic wrap. It's a little shiny. But if somebody throws some mashed potatoes behind it, that's what your kid's otitis media looks like. Maybe a big thing of vanilla pudding. This diagnosis has to be made clinically. You just have to look at a lot of ears to be able to decide. Some people worry about overcalling these and saying, oh, we're treating so many of these otitis media. We're giving kids antibiotics that they don't need. And that probably does happen. We give people antibiotics all the time. But there is a very well-studied practice of giving parents a prescription to wait and hold that the majority of patients won't fill it. If you say, here's some prescriptions because it's Saturday, you're not going to get in to see your doctor, hold on to it. And if your kid continues to have fevers tomorrow, if your kid starts to have worsening pain you can't control with Tylenol or ibuprofen over the next 24 hours, go ahead and fill it. And most parents won't fill it. They'll watch it. So that is an accepted practice you can do. On the other hand, a lot of people worry about undercalling these. They say that if we don't treat it, they're going to develop mastoiditis, they're going to get meningitis, they're going to get all these other things. And there's actually a recent study that shows that whether you treat treat them or not, it's not going to make a difference. So the ear infection is not going to make a difference. So if we're not going to kill kids by withholding antibiotics from ear infections, what's the worst thing that can happen? Well, they're in pain. I don't want any kid to be in pain. But the next worst thing is that their eardrum could rupture. So personally, having had an eardrum rupture, it felt better once it finally ruptured. And you get these little pinholes that leak out some blood or some pus. And the only change at that point is to make sure you don't get water in your ear, don't submerge your head so that you get water into the middle ear and throw everything off your balance and whatnot. But if parents do end up finding that their kids have this, I say there's still nothing much we're going to do in the emergency department. Sometimes it just gets bad. And it'll heal up, and it's not necessarily going to cause any problems. It's such a small perforation that it's probably not going to cause any issues.
Yeah, I end up using very little antibiotics for acute otitis media anymore. I do a wait and see with just about everybody. If they have a double ear infection, which is one of the things I love hearing on Facebook, so my kid has a double ear infection, that means it's a virus. Because pathologically, for bacteria to go from one inner ear through the eustachian tubes, up the nose, crossing the nose through the sinuses, back and off to the other one, I just don't see that as happening. My kid had a triple ear infection. It was horrible. I peed my pants and gave them Tylenol and Motrin. So personally, I think whether you give antibiotics or not, I think reducing antibiotics in general is a good thing. Like Aaron said, there's very few complications with these. I do think a lot of primary physicians probably overcall this, but I do think if you are doing it wrong if you're not giving something for pain, because no antibiotic has ever cured pain in the history of penicillin since the 1940s. You need to give these kids pain. They come in for pain. So if you send them home with amoxicillin, but you don't give them a prescription for Motrin and Tylenol, or you don't give them some decongestants because their nose is really clogged up, or some way to help alleviate that eustachian tube dysfunction that's caused some swelling and caused some, I think you're missing and hurting the child more than you're helping them.
So the treatment first line is going to be amoxicillin. You're trying to get strep pneumo. You're trying to get Moroxella, the same stuff that's going to cause your sinusitis, your ear infections, everything else.
I think almost all H&T infections go with the encapsulate organisms.
So the eardrum perforation that you get from an otitis, not that bad. The eardrum perforation you get from trauma, you worry that you're going to offset your ossicles and have permanent hearing lost. So those patients that have had stuck something in their ear, be it a car key or a Q-tip or whatever else it happens to be, the worst I had was a dad who his kid was on his shoulders eating a lollipop, and the kid just kind of grabbed it like a dagger and just shoved it right in his dad's ear. It just kills. So they need to see an ENT. But the other treatment, totally the same. And the last is foreign body retrieval in the ears. I'll be honest, I don't try that hard to retrieve foreign bodies in the ears. We stink at it. It's really difficult to do. Foreign bodies in the nose, we have to go after because they can become an airway problem. The one caveat I would say for any foreign body is button batteries, because they cause that liquefactive necrosis.
Batteries, and I'd also comment, anything organic you would be more worried about in their ear, too. So if it's a plastic bead or something, it can be there. It'll cause some irritation, but if it doesn't come out tonight, that's okay. But if you have some vegetative material,
like a cockroach,
or like a, you know, someone sticks a grass clippings or something in their ear, that over time will cause a worse infection than anything else.
So I will absolutely try to get stuff out of the ear. If I can't get it out of the ear, I say you need to see an ear, nose, and throat doctor tomorrow or the next day. But it's generally not going to cause trouble. If it's a button battery, you got to get it out. For some of this foreign body retrieval, ear, nose, and throat docs that we work with have told me if you have alligator forceps, bayonet forceps, some kind of a right angle tool, and suction, you can get pretty much everything else out. And after that, it's just your comfort with working in small spaces.
Ow! You broke my nose! Oh! There's so much blood!
After you've tried to retrieve these, you usually induce a little bit of epistaxis. Epistaxis is probably the thing that I think most doctors in general hate the most. Would you agree? ENTs, yeah. Emergency doctors?
Yeah. Bleeding in the nose or a post-tonsillectomy bleed, I think, are probably things that bother and scare people more than anything else.
So for starters, you have to apply direct pressure. That is the way to treat any bleeding anywhere. Apply direct pressure to the area of bleeding so that you can start to clot off. Now, that's not going to be as easy as somebody on Coumadin and somebody on Plavix, but you try to apply direct pressure. And I tell people, you have to hold it for 10 minutes. I do too, but you can't. Hold it for 10 minutes. And they look at it. They hold it, and then they take it off. I go, 10 minutes, start over. You just lost 2 minutes. You got to start over. And I really make them do it because that's the best way to stop it. You can also, I like people that do the oxymetolazone, the phenylephrine-soaked cotton swabs that will try to help reduce some of the vasculature there. And then if you can get it down in Kesselbach's plexus for the anterior bleeds, you can use some silver nitrate to try to cauterize it. If it's still actively bleeding, you're going to cauterize blood, and you're not actually going to cauterize the bleeding. So you have to stop the bleeding before you stick the swab in their nose.
Yeah, and make them blow their nose before you do any of these, because you want to remove the clot. You want the medicines that you're giving to get up next to that tissue and cause some vasoconstriction. It's okay to use lidocaine with epinephrine-soaked gauze. It's okay to use cocaine-soaked gauze. Both are anesthetic if you're going to do cautery, and they're vasoconstrictive. So they help out in two ways, and then add the pressure on top of that. Let these people sit, assuming they're not tasting blood constantly down the back of their throat. You're going to be okay doing this for a little bit.
The only time cocaine-soaked gauze has not worked is if the nosebleed was caused by cocaine.
Yeah.
Practically speaking, don't make them tilt their head backwards. That's how you get them to aspirate blood. Practically speaking, don't tell them to pinch above the nose. No, that you're squeezing your bone.
Yeah,
squeeze right below the bony part. Now, when that's failed, you have to start sticking something back in there to tamponade the bleeding. So if you have to do the bleeding, they have the short packing and they have the long packing. I'll be honest, I always go for the long packing because if I want to do this, it's incredibly uncomfortable. I want to do it once.
Correct. And the questions they're going to ask on the boards will be anterior, posterior, which is most common, anterior. Most of them you see it, Kesselbach's plexus. Sometimes you can see it. And then packing, if you do pack them, a lot of times they'll say antibiotics or no antibiotics. Aaron, what do they recommend usually?
They usually still recommend antibiotics.
They still recommend antibiotics, even though we're starting to see some studies that say antibiotics probably aren't needed. If you're posteriorly packing the nose, they usually recommend admission, especially on the boards. So.
Now, if this bleeding is because of trauma, somebody got punched in the nose, you want to look for two things. There's really only two things when you get hit in the nose with a basketball like Marsha Brady. There's two things we care about. The first is, do you have a nasal septal hematoma? It's a bluish discoloration and swelling on the medial aspect of the septum. If that's there, you got to incise it or else you're going to run into problems. If it's not there, don't worry about it. If the nose is deviated because it's broken, try to put it back in place. And other than that, there's nothing else we can do about a broken nose.
Right. And you'll want to look at your septal hematoma. Look at both sides. It usually is occurring only on one. It can occur bilaterally, but usually one. So you have the other side to compare to if you're not sure.
All right, let's finish out with throat stuff. So everybody has a sore throat this time of year. It's going to be viral almost all the time. It's going to be viral. But they're going to want you to know your CENTAUR criteria because it's a well-published, well-known paper. Surprisingly, if you have all four CENTAUR criteria, your likelihood of having strep throat, 55%.
It's a coin flip.
That's not that great. So your CENTAUR criteria, if you have fever, cervical lymphadenopathy,
no upper respiratory symptoms,
no upper respiratory symptoms, and exudative pharyngitis. Those are going to be your CENTAUR criteria that you're going to chase after. If you have a couple of those, you can decide to test. If you do a rapid swab, unless they have the PCR, which we have now, which is very accurate, if you just do a regular ELISA test, I believe it is, then they're going to want you to do a culture to make sure. You empirically treat with penicillin because you're trying to prevent rheumatic heart disease. We're not going to go into that because this is for
that's my
the exam.
Yeah.
This is for the exam. we'll talk about that for 7 hours at a different recording. Yes. The other confounders, if it's not group A strep, exudative pharyngitis, so mono, EBV, give you a horrible sore throat. The difference between the two is if you have a palpable spleen on the exam or if you have posterior cervical lymphadenopathy.
Or you may have a protracted course. They may describe this has been going on for 3 or 4 weeks with some intermittent belly pain and those other findings.
And the other one, if it is an awful sore throat with horrible pus and somebody who has high risk behavior, think gonococcal as well. So let's say that strep throat was left untreated or decided to manifest. You've got a couple deep spaces in the neck that you want to be worried about. You worry about retropharyngeal abscesses between the retropharynx and the vertebrae. You worry about peritonsillar abscesses next to the tonsil. And you worry about a Ludwig's angina, an abscess in the deep space of the neck. So the difference between these is basically going to be with a retropharyngeal abscess, you're going to have nuchal rigidity. You're going to have torticollis. You're not going to want to move your neck because every time you move that vertebrae, it's going to rub against pus, which especially in a child, usually less than age 3, maybe with some posterior pharynx trauma, they'll say that the kid is drooling, the kid looks ill, and the kid doesn't want to move their neck. That is going to be totally different from a peritonsillar abscess where it's right next to the giant jaw muscles and causes trismus. They'll be able to move their neck all over, they won't be able to open their mouth. And you should see asymmetry of the tonsil.
Yeah, the peritonsillar abscess will need incision and drainage, either by you or ENT. Antibiotics, either Clinda or Augmentin, will be your two that you're going to be recommended. Like Aaron said, the difficulty opening the jaw, they may report on uvular deviation or a peritonsillar fullness. If you have a retropharyngeal abscess or parapharyngeal abscess, they may comment on a posterior pharynx bulge. The patient may be sitting forward and leaning forward. They don't want to lay down, or they may describe you try to lay them down. They're not comfortable with that. They won't want to move their neck. They usually look ill. And these are ones that we don't drain and will need ENT to evaluate for drainage. And a lot of them, they end up doing IV antibiotics and admission. You would do more than just an x-ray. X-rays only for, they may still have some x-rays on there for epiglottitis. You may see the thumbprint sign on a lateral neck. You may see some increased space differences in the for like a posterior pharyngeal abscess in front of the vertebral bodies. Usually we think of in adults, like 6 at C2, 22 millimeters at C6. But if it's 3 times the size of that vertebral body width, just they're trying to show you something. And that's probably what they're going to show you.
It's not going to be subtle.
It's not going to be subtle. It'll be like 3 times that that space is enlarged.
And then the last one would be the Ludwig's angina. This is usually a deep space anterior neck infection. It'll probably be from a bad tooth. And what they'll describe is this woodiness or hardness under the floor of the mouth. So under the tongue, you'll squeeze and you'll see that they're also not able to move their neck because it hurts. But it hurts because they basically have a necrotizing infection of the anterior space of their neck. All of these need to be drained. You need to drain the pus, and all of this pus goes down into the chest. The Ludwig's angina is the one that's most concerning because it seems to spread the fastest, but the retropharyngeal abscess can also spread pretty quickly down inferiorly into the chest. And then you go from needing an ENT to an ENT and a thoracic surgeon. So broad spectrum antibiotics, usually something like clindamycin and admission with ENT consultation is going to be the treatment. We can drain, as Brian said, peritonsillar abscesses in the emergency department, use an ultrasound, use a blind method. The big problem that you worry about is hitting the carotid. You won't hit the carotid if you come from the ipsilateral side. If you try to cross over, you got a better chance of hitting that carotid artery. So I think that wraps up ENT. H-E-N-T. We hope you enjoyed this. If you don't, please let us know because we won't do it anymore. Please go home, read a book.
You guys will all do great. You've done your studying up to now, so this is just a quick biz buzz review for you so you get those couple extra questions.
Hopefully it was worth your while. We'll see you guys in March.
See ya.
Easy like Sunday.